From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, October 4th, 2018. And on this day, the state has repealed its mandate that districts move toward proficiency-based high school diplomas. It's creating some confusion. And we'll continue our series on aquaculture in Maine with a look at the state's oyster-growing industry. That's ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, presenting Gardens Aglow, where visitors will see the gardens in a whole new light. Tickets available at mainegardens.org.
First tonight, some good news. State wildlife biologists say the number of bald eagles in Maine has increased by 16% in the last 5 years. Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife Endangered Species Coordinator Charlie Todd says eagle numbers have grown in all 16 counties. He says numbers are still particularly strong in Washington and Hancock counties, but are starting to level off there.
And that's okay because the numbers are so good now.
Todd says Maine's good habitat for bald eagles, with lots of nearby water for the birds, which eat fish.
Good food is just the first step. Number two is some remoteness, some good trees. Maine has no shortage of trees, right?
DDT use led bald eagle numbers in Maine to plummet after World War II. Biologists say the low point was 1967, when only 21 nesting pairs were found in Maine. This year's aerial survey found 733 nesting pairs. Maine schools are at a crossroads. Earlier this year, the legislature repealed a six-year-old mandate that districts abandon their traditional graduation requirements and move toward proficiency-based diplomas. Some have decided to stay the course on proficiency standards. Others have chosen to return to the former credit-based system. And as Robbie Feinberg reports, some districts are still not certain about how to proceed.
Yes, ma'am. Quickly and quietly, come sit at the front of the room.
Things can get a bit chaotic inside Marsha Bucher Elementary School in Richmond. The fourth and fifth graders are combined and share four teachers. They dart from classroom to classroom throughout the day in a way that looks more like high school.
What kinds of things do you wonder about surviving out in the wild in Maine?
In the afternoon, students participate in what are called applied learning seminars, where they get to decide what they want to learn. This seminar is about personal health and explores how to survive in the Maine wilderness. Students work in small groups, asking big questions that they'll eventually answer over the next few weeks.
Or how would you get fish?
You could make a spear.
Well, yeah, you could do that.
How would you
make a spear?
This transformation towards what the district calls personalized learning began about a decade ago. Students now receive grades of 3s and 4s instead of A's and B's. They can redo assignments, and they're constantly grouped and regrouped into different classes depending on how far along they are in a certain subject. Fifth grader William Cooper says the new approach requires more responsibility, but has pushed him academically.
It moves you out of your comfort zone, but then it extends your comfort zone once you get used to it.
This district, RSU2, says it's seen success with this model as it's moved towards proficiency-based diplomas that were mandated in 2012. The law required students to be proficient in certain content areas in order to graduate. It did not mandate that schools change how they teach, but many districts still adopted reforms like new grading systems, software, and redos on tests. Yet with limited resources and guidance on how to implement so many changes, some struggled. Maine Education Association President Grace Levitt.
Basically funding, the time to do this, the staff to do it, the resources to do it, and being sure that we're able to meet the needs of all students were major concerns.
Those concerns and similar worries from parents ultimately led the state to repeal the proficiency-based diploma requirements this past July. And that's left many districts facing a major decision to either continue implementing the new diploma system or to revert back to credit-based diplomas that have been used for decades. For some, the decision has been relatively simple. In York, Superintendent Lou Gazinski says members of the community had already opposed proficiency-based education, so it made sense to return to a credit-based system.
And so we decided to jump on that early after the law changed because we knew there wasn't a lot of support for that particular model moving forward.
But for some districts, such as RSU 9 in Farmington,
it's an open question.
Superintendent Tina Maserv says she supports many aspects of proficiency-based education, but she worries that the new law could create two unequal diploma systems with different requirements. Maserv points to subjects such as health and world languages, which are required for a proficiency-based diploma, but not for a credit-based one.
So what I've told the board is if it stays that way, I'm going to recommend we go to a traditional transcript because you don't not give somebody a diploma because they can't show proficiency in a world language when kid across the river is getting a diploma because they're in a traditional-based, transcript.
And Eileen King, the deputy director for the Maine School Management Association, says the new law also opens up questions about how to treat students who move to a new school district.
So how do we honor students that transfer from a high school that's doing credit-based to proficiency or vice versa? So that's becoming a real discussion and struggle, is we're going to have kids in two systems.
Last week, the Maine Department of Education released its first guidance to districts explaining the difference between the two diploma systems. In an email, the department's chief of planning and implementation, Mary Payne, says it's likely that the legislature will have to step in and help sort out some of the uncertainties. But for now, Payne says the department plans to have more conversations with stakeholders and, quote, decide on the direction we need to take. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
And for disclosure, the Maine Education Association represents most of Maine Public's news staff. Education reporting on Maine Public Radio is supported by a grant from the Nellie Mae Education Foundation. This week in our special series, Aquaculture's Next Wave, we are looking at the innovations taking seafood farming to new levels in Maine. Today, Fred Bever profiles the state's oyster growing industry and novel attempts to protect the harvest against the effects of climate change, or even take advantage of them.
Here on a cove out on the eastern side of Casco Bay's Chabig Island, a receding tide reveals dozens of wire cages. They rest akimbo on the sand and sparkle in the sun. And for island native Jeff Putnam, they hold treasure inside. Bags and bags of young oysters.
This one here is probably 2 years old, I would guess. Looking at the shell, you can see the first year growth. And then all this fingernail looking growth on the end is from this year.
Putnam's main business is lobstering, same as it was for his father. But this winter, his boat will do double duty, hauling tens of thousands of his first harvest of mature Sandy Point oysters to market at 70 cents or so apiece. For Putnam, it's not just about diversifying his revenue streams. It's about a future on the island for his three young children.
Hopefully the lobster resource will still be strong when they grow up, but there's certainly no guarantee that's the case. So I wanted to show them and other kids, that are living on the island and coastal communities, that there is another way to make a living.
As with many lobstermen, Putnam is reluctant to weigh in on climate change. But over the years, he's witnessed the gradual warming of these waters and the collapse of lobster fisheries in the Long Island Sound and off Massachusetts. It's a warning. The lobster boom could bust.
And with the water being warm and the oyster stuff seeming to do well with these warmer waters, that seemed a natural fit. I didn't base my decision off of a Time magazine article or something. I looked at kind of real world, what's going on, what can I do to support my family to stay on this island that I love.
But the oyster industry, too, is at risk from the effects of climate change.
There is real money at stake, and it's already costing us.
Bill Mook is one of Maine's most prolific oyster farmers. He and his employees harvest millions of them a year from a fertile estuary in the Damariscotta River, where oyster production has tripled over the last decade, right through the recession. But Mook says there's a rising problem, more frequent and more intense rain events driven by climate change can send polluted runoff into the river. And in response, the state closes down the harvest.
We did have three in a row over a period of like 2 months. So you know, cumulatively, that is probably almost $30,000 of lost sales.
Climate change is bringing other challenges. Ocean acidification, which affects shell development, for one, and potential outbreaks of Vibrio. That's a bacteria that can be quite toxic for humans who eat contaminated oysters. It's been moving north as warmer waters and air temperatures encourage its growth. But for toxins and rain closures too, MOOC has a solution.
So this room will hold 500,000 oysters when it's up fully running.
He's just now finishing out this $2 million, 9,000 square foot facility, which he designed expressly to defend the farm's crop against climate change and maybe even get a leg up on his competitors. In a cavernous room, 4 foot by 4 foot tanks laden with mature oysters are stacked high in the air. Seawater that's UV purified and temperature controlled flows from ceiling pipes down through the stacks. Underneath the floor, turbines power away the wastewater to be skimmed and recirculated.
Basically keeps anything from settling in the tank. So all the oyster poop and any grit or anything just keeps it up in the water.
Late last month, MOOC and his staff hustled tens of thousands of mature oysters out of the river and into the facility. That was ahead of heavy rains expected in the aftermath of Hurricane Florence. So when the state put neighboring farms' river oysters off limits, MOOC Sea Farm was able to harvest them straight from the facility and get them to market. And down the line, if Vibrio shuts down the Damariscotta oyster harvest for an extended period, MOOC says he'll decontaminate the oysters here. He'll need FDA approval for that, but he believes he'll get it.
Climate change is costing us, and yet it also offers some opportunities that we hope will allow us to be resilient and sustain this business and the people I've been under employ, you know, into the future.
People like Jeff Auger, the farm's river foreman. Auger trained to be a lawyer, but he says aquaculture innovations are proving to be a magnet for him and other young Mainers.
You know, at the end of the day, you go out to the bar and you see other young professionals that are on oyster farms. And for communities and areas like this that are kind of struggling, I think it's the answer.
Company founder Bill MOOC says he can envision a day when climate change forces Maine oysters to be hatched and grown entirely indoors, never touching the wild river. But he adds, that would be a very sad day. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Thursday, October 4th, 2018. Thanks to Ed Morin and to our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.